My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clancy.
I think I've given the opinion to some people over the years that I'm kind of a crusty old guy, or kind of intolerant, or not pleasant. But I was sitting there thinking tonight, if a doctor told me, and it may happen, I suppose, if I had one day left, he said, if you had one day left to live, and he would say, you have just have one day left to live, you know what I'd do? I'd grab a plane, and I'd come here to Ocean City, and I'd ask Bonnie to do a countdown for us. It would make that last day seem like forever. But I'm very happy to be here, Dad. I want to thank Popeye and his charming wife, Charlotte, for picking me up at the airport and bringing Heroes of Dispatch. And people have been very kind to me. And I've enjoyed the convention, the speakers. I know all the speakers. The only one I missed was Peggy. And I guess I'll hear her in a couple months because she comes out and speaks at my birthday every year in Los Angeles. And it's been a very nice convention, very easygoing, very pleasant, very good, nice weather. Everything's been very nice about it. I want to thank my friend Dick, who has been very kind, and Bob and Dick, who I sponsor here, who are here, and some visitors here from Los Angeles, even. You know, I'm glad someone acknowledged the fact to say a word to the flag. I'm in that rapidly decreasing group called World War II veterans. In the paper, it says that 1,500 of us, on the average, die every day. So I get up early every morning and look at those obits. If I'm not in there, I'm okay. But it is interesting about days, though, you know. Most everybody remembers where they were when they heard about the planes crashing into this. Like everybody's heard about the days. You knew where you were exactly when you heard that Kennedy had been killed or shot. Or you knew exactly where you were. If you're as old as I am, I was in high school at play practice when they heard about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. We couldn't imagine what the hell they'd be bombing Hawaii for, because all we knew was that's where Hawaii grapefruit came from. And I remember when I was a boy, people making such a to-do that Wiley Post died. You probably never heard of him. But he was an air pilot, and he and Will Rogers were taking a trip around the world, and they crashed up in Alaska and died. And I remember the day that Gene Harlow died. That's the last I remember. Well, but there's another day I'm sure we all remember, and that other day is the day we got sober. That's the day you remember. You might not remember every little detail, but I had a bad day that day. I woke up in the morning at 5 o'clock, and some guy came around and said, "Okay, you bums, out!" I was in an all-night theater on Skid Row. I don't know if you know what all-night theater is. They don't run all night. They run until 5 o'clock. And it's a good place to sleep, where you can sleep for 15 or 20 cents a night. And you try to find a movie that doesn't have a lot of gunplay in it and things like that. But they round us up and push us out of the street, you know, raining. I didn't know, knew hardly anybody in Los Angeles. Didn't know anybody. One guy, and I already burned him off. And rain, stand there, kind of cold. It's terrible waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning going out in the cold rain. And some guy said to me, you want to sell a pint of blood for $4? I said, I sure do, yeah. So we went up. He took me about 8 blocks up the street where there was a blood bank. It sounds kind of cruel now, but it was kind of funny over the years, you know. All these guys go there 5:30 before 6 o'clock in the morning, and they're all terribly sick. And they're all standing outside there in the rain, kind of just going like this. And from a distance, it looks like people are dancing up there. They call it the dance hall. Go up to the dance hall and wait for a while. And they finally let us in and took a drop of blood in my ear and said, you don't have enough iron in your blood to sell a pint of blood. I said, Jesus, I got to do something. I'm so sick. He said, down here about four blocks, there's something called the Midnight Mission. They help bums like you. Why don't you go down there and have some breakfast? I said, all right. So I went down during the rain. I went to this Midnight Mission. I said, I'd like to have some breakfast, please. He said, God, you just missed it. We just got done serving. You can have lunch. Come back in 4 hours. I said, I can't wait 4 hours. Please let me have something to eat. He said, sorry, we're done. And I grabbed his lapel. I said, you don't understand. You get it. And two guys came over. Each took my hand off and took me to the door and threw me physically out through the door. Don't come back here, you son of a bitch. I tried to explain to him, I'm not a son of a bitch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Collier's, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's hard to explain these things in midair. After I said that damn old mission in the cold rain, feeling so terrible I didn't know what to do, where to turn. If some guy would come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. They used to call you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost all your clothes. Remember that car the guy gave you to drive from Dallas to Los Angeles? You got drunk in Phoenix and lost it. And all your clothes, all your ID, all your money. Remember that's the night you got in jail and got sick in the middle of the night and threw up on somebody's bunk, and that's why the guy kicked out your front teeth, and that's why you got no teeth now and you're bleeding down the front of your shirt. And he might have said, your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you, her only child, because your stepfather is so tired of watching you play on her emotions, so she'll go down to her tiny little bank account, take out a few more dollars, and send it to her little boy and try to help him. He'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. And he could have said, and you've been going to AA now for 10 years, and you sit in these meetings all over the country and smirk and think how stupid these people are. If the heat wasn't on you, you wouldn't be there. And their little steps, their little traditions, and their little slogans, and their hypocrisy. He said, now you're dying, he might have said. And he might have said, why don't you go back to AA one more time and try admitting you're an alcoholic, really, and see what happens. And if someone had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have to say, you don't understand. It's not the way it looks. I'm not an alcoholic. By this time, I wish I were. I would give anything to be that simple. I wish I were an alcoholic. I wish I could, when I stopped drinking, things got better. But my problems are not like, I drink like an alcoholic, but that's the only thing like it. I don't know how to explain to people. There's something wrong inside of me. And I don't, when I get sober, it becomes obvious. And I drink to ease it off, and then I drink too much, and people think my problem is alcohol. I don't know how to explain this to anybody. They say, alcoholics can't stop drinking. I can stop drinking. I've stopped drinking many times. My problem has never been that I can't stop drinking. My problem is much more complex. After I stop drinking, and I feel good maybe for 2 or 3 days, someone seems to sneak into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut, and the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It comes out as, little growing restlessness, little irritability, come on, little tired of my daily sermon I get from my wife, what I did this time, get off it! Just little by little watching whatever technicolor there is in my life slowly go back to gray. The damn job becomes gray again, and this damn street becomes gray, and this house becomes gray, and my children become gray, and my life is gray, and when I was working, I spent thousands and thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to try to break that pattern. But I'll tell you something odd. You may have discovered this if you're a slipper. I guess most of the people here in their first couple of weeks of sobriety are slippers, because nobody in the first 2 weeks of sobriety ever go to a convention. Incidentally, I wanted to say something to the young girl who's one day sober. It really hurts me when people one day sober look healthier than I do. Could you at least get a black eye or get your hair mussed or some goddamn thing? You know, just... I don't judge. But I've tried so many things to break that pattern. You know how you break it? It's a sad thing. You have one drink. And then you must say, this time I'll watch it. And that's happened to me time after time after time. And I just don't explain to people. Getting sober may make these people feel happy. It makes me crazy. I don't know why it is. They say that alcoholics can't stay sober. If you have a good enough reason. I stayed sober once, and I had an excellent reason. In the mid-1950s, I went through a little pattern in my life where when I got to the right stage of drinking, I would go out and counsel police officers. That's a stupid thing to do, but every time I thought it would be different this time. And I got arrested a lot, just thrown in jail overnight, you know, to cool you off. And I got so I come out in the morning, go home, take a shower, and go to work. I could really handle it. But I got out of jail one morning, and my neighbor was there. That never happened to me before. And I said, well, you shouldn't have come down here. This cop was really a fascist. I've got his badge number. I'm going to get him. I'm going to get his job somehow. He said, I don't know about all that. He said, but while you're out drunk, your little son died, and we couldn't find you. And, oh, God, that just about put a knife in my heart. I had three little girls and one little boy, and he was the apple of my eye. I had a future for him laid out, and I went almost crazy. We took him to Wisconsin, buried him in the grave, I mean, at the foot of his grandmother's grave, and when I was up there, I put my hand in his casket, and I said, John Immersland, this will never happen again. I am so sorry. I can't tell you. And I came back, and I stopped drinking. And I didn't go to AA, didn't read any books or nothing. I stopped drinking because I wanted to stop drinking. And I'd come home from night, from work, and I'd have dinner with my family, first time in a long time, on a continuing basis. After, sometimes, I'd help mother homework. If they got done, we'd take them for a ride down to the Dairy Queen and get an ice cream cone. And she had a wonderful time. It was just wonderful. And every meal, we said a little prayer for baby John's soul, that he would be good in heaven. And I was not of their faith. My family, I married a Catholic girl. My children were Catholic. But I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. But we all agreed on that one subject. We wanted to pray for John's soul. And it was just maybe the best 2 or 3 weeks of my life up to that time almost. And then one night, wouldn't you know it, somebody moved, came into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day, just a little edgy, tired of this. Just a little bit wondering why my little boy would die. What kind of crap is that? And just and 2 or 3 days of that, and the pressure mounting, it came to me, of course. This Norwegian Lutheran God who I had tried to, in my limited way, try to be good for, it didn't do very well, but I tried, took my little boy that never committed a sin in his life and killed him to punish me because I was a sinner. Well, you son of a bitch, I'm done with you. You'll get me when I'm going to go to hell when I die. I know that, but I don't have to put up with your crap now. And that was the end of my relationship with God ever. But, the days just kept on going. And pretty soon I got so terribly tired, tense and tired. I turned to my daughter, Mary, take your sisters and go to your room, for Christ's sake. Don't make so much noise. I'm sorry. I don't mean it. We'll play tomorrow. Just, everything that way, I needed a drink so bad I could scream. But I promised my dead little son I wouldn't take a drink. And one day my wife took the children to Mass. And I was at the point, I just pulled the car in the garage and hooked up a hose on the exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. Just crazed, didn't know what to do. And a neighbor apparently was sitting in his breakfast nook having some coffee and saw me go in there and heard the motor running, and I didn't come out, so he wandered over and found me dead in the car and pulled me out and breathed in my chest and breathed in my mouth and called the ambulance, and they rushed me to the hospital and they examined me and deoxygenated me, and After about 5 days, they had come to the conclusion, this man is seriously mentally ill, and committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period, maybe the rest of my life. Now, that's how I get when I stop drinking. That's not an alcohol problem. If I'd had some alcohol, I could have beat it, but I couldn't. And I think about that sometimes. They classified me as a schizophrenic, some sort of a dual personality with paranoid tendencies. I'd like to go back too late now, of course, but I'd like to find that psychiatrist. I mean, he must be about 95 now, and I could move him around pretty good. Like, you quack! You ought to be ashamed diagnosing me as a dual personality, for crying out loud. If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have been all right. Yeah. Like Beth, unfortunately, I have a lot of personalities in my brain that talk to, you know. I used to, you know, I just sit, stand there and think and hear the voices go, let's get out of here. Don't think we can. What do you think they'll do? I don't know. Let's, you know. I used to hear people say years ago, I don't think AA is enough for me. I may need group therapy. Not me. I just go for a ride alone in my car. But I was there about 2 weeks, and I was protected from the world, and I was sorry for what I'd done. And I thought, I got to get out of here. I might be here forever. And you know, you don't sleep well in the state hospital. Just as you doze off from another ward comes, I thought, Jesus, I'm neurotic, but I'm not like these people. And I thought, I got to get out of here. And some big goof attendant said, don't ever try to run away from this place, boy. It's escape-proof hospital. I thought, oh, is that so? Took me about a week and a half to find a way to get through a door and down a corridor and through another door and across the yard and over the fence. And I was gone. And after I got over the fence, I realized what the man said is true. It is an escape-proof hospital at Big Spring, Texas. I don't know if you've ever been there, but you suddenly realize they can see you running for 3 days. It's just, you feel like such a fool in your white bathrobe. Just. Why, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they snatched me back and gave me a couple months of intense electric shock therapy for that run. And I never tried to run again. Sometimes they couldn't even tell. What's your name, boy? I'm not sure. That's what the desk had. Electric shock therapy in those days was brutal. It looks much nicer now. But I was starting to come out of it a little bit in early December, and they saw on my record that I had done this dramatic direction and staging of a grand opera at the University of Texas at El Paso that spring. So they asked me if I'd like to direct the Christmas pageant. So I did that. It wasn't very complex. It was just trying to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary if you possibly could. Get back, Lamar. Just trying to worship her, Clay, and say. And then the next year I was still there. You know, it gets to be, when you're there for a long period, you begin to think, this is not going to look good on my resume. That's why most of us have resumes that say, self-employed during this period. Consultant to a company no longer in business. But of all things, they started a man in that city was a very active AA member. He'd been operating with the city for the state for years to try an experimental alcoholic ward in the state hospital system. And when I was there, they put that experimental hospital ward in that hospital. Now, somebody had a shock to me by this time, and this was the next year. But I know Mr. Ross, he was an AA member, and he had this Ward 9 where they could teach him about AA. And they had a program, you know, because nobody would go there voluntarily, but your family could sign you in for 30 days, no matter what you felt about it. If they could prove you're a drunkard, you just go in there for 30 days, and they have to let you out. But I thought, I know, but this time I'd been around AA for years. I know how to hustle AAs, get simpletons. So I waited. I was the mailman at the hospital by this time, and I was living in this senile ward because that was the closest thing I had to me. And I saw Mr. Ross. I said, "Mr. Ross, I'm here on a commitment from El Paso. And I, because of my drinking, and I don't know what to do about it. My life was so good sometimes, but that drinking, do you have any sort of a program I could follow? Or do you have any sort of a book or any literature? Do you have meetings or anything?" And his eyes went, he'd never seen a sincere newcomer. He said, I'll get back to you, boy. And he never got back to me. I thought he burned me off. He zeroed me. But he got back to me 3 or 4 days later. He had to go to Austin to get permission to allow a psychiatric patient into the alcoholic ward. And I went in there, and I became the best patient they ever had. Because I was the only one who knew what they wanted, the answers they wanted. Mr. Ross would give us an hour-long talk on the 12 steps. Just made us all crazy. He said, "Are there any questions?" You want to say, "Yes, why don't you kill yourself?" But that wouldn't help. So I have a question, Mr. Ross. Could you tell us more about the 4th and 5th steps, how we can get that garbage out that's so difficult for us, and we find a way to get out of our system so we can go on to help others? He said, "Yes, I'll be pleased to tell you about that, Clancy." And the rest of the room would say, "Oh, shit." But I wasn't caring about that. I was trying to get him. And pretty soon I got to be secretary of the group because they just came and went every 30 days, but I stayed. And eventually they start taking me out to little towns around there, Odessa and Midland, and give little talks to the A groups. And I had a wonderful little talk. I said, "Friends, I'm here tonight on behalf of my fellow patients at Big Spring State Hospital to thank each and every one of you for bringing meetings to our hospital and taking us. It's as though we were going across a vast desert of alcoholism. And we came to the tall green hills of sobriety, but they were too steep for our weary legs. But wonderful folks such as you pointed out 12 golden steps that we could take one after another. And now as we reach the end of our steps and start reaching the top of this wonderful mountain, we're looking forward to returning to our homes throughout Texas and finding other lost wayfarers and say, 'Over here, there's a better way.' And I owe it all to you and the wonderful God you represent. Thank you." You could laugh. Got me out of the Texas Nut House. And I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But I can stop drinking if I have to. But stop drinking to me puts me in the Nut House or dead or something. And I rested in the rain outside of that damn mission, cold. Nobody came up and talked to me. But I learned one more thing in the last few months when I was really getting my drinking was bad. It's when you get to a bad situation where you smell bad and look bad and nobody wants anything to do with you, there's one place you're always welcome. Try to find an AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. "This one's mine, Fred." So I said to some turkey status, I didn't speak where we had no front teeth. Where's the A Club around here, pal? So there's nothing downtown. There's one on Wilshire and Fairfax. And where the hell is that? He said, you have to go up this hill to Hill Street, then cut over to Wilshire, then walk west. Then you come to Fairfax. And away I went. And I walked and walked and walked and walked and walked in the rain and cold and sick and desperate. I counted later in my car 7.5 miles in the rain. But I'll tell you something. If you've ever been down and out drinking, you realize there are times you do things you can't possibly do, because if you don't, there's no alternative. I got to this damn old club. This was still my last day. And I walked in and some old fool was standing and said, "Welcome home, son." Oh, Jesus. So I slunk in and tried to stay out of sight all day so that nobody would read to me out of the book. I'd read the book and found it lacking. And at night they got us all together and said, "Okay, it's meeting time. Everybody has to go to a meeting now, our meeting in the club." All right, so I sat down. And at least they served cake at the meeting. I ate about 4 pounds of cake because I could chew that. And then they had a meeting on gratitude, and I almost vomited the cake up again. Just, oh, meh. And then everybody went home. Just the manager and I were left. I didn't know what to... I knew he was going to throw me out. What did I do? Go out in that rain and die. He said, boy, he said, about time to close her down. I thought, I knew it. So what I did, I went to the whip. I went to what I conceived to be my newcomer look. And I said, I'm a newcomer. And I have no place to stay. And it's raining, and I'm so cold and sick. Could you help me? He said, you're in luck, kid. A guy named Joe Quinn left a 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. Doesn't run, but it's dry. You can sleep in there. I said, your answer here is to have me sleep in an abandoned car? He says, yeah, good deal, huh? I said, I don't know. But I slept in that old abandoned car. The next morning I woke up, it was still raining. It turned out to be a Sunday morning, although I didn't know it. And they opened the doors early for a Sunday morning meeting. And I went in there as soon as they opened up at 8 o'clock, and they laid out some more cake for the meeting, and I ate all that, or most of it. Then they had a spiritual meeting at 9 o'clock, and as soon as they talked about God, I just got up and left. I don't want to hear that crap. And that day I hung around there. I found some guys upstairs watching a football game. I watched a pro football game for a while. I could stand that. And at night there's another meeting and some more cake, and I ate that. And just another dreadful meeting, people getting up and talking about how wonderful their lives were. Some of them stopped drinking. At the end of that meeting, manager came over and says, you know, boy, you can come in here during the week, but you have to be a member then. On the weekends you can come in all as you've done. But during the week, you've got to be a member, or else you can't come in at the daytime. Come in at night. He said, but you're such a mess. You'll die in my parking lot. I'll have to fill out all those papers. He said, you can come in, but there are three little rules. You can't ask anyone for money, and nobody wants any more of your smart-aleck remarks, and you've got to go to a meeting every night. I thought, Jesus. If I had a coin, I'd flip it. This is terrible. I said, all right. So for the next few days, I went to a meeting. It just kept raining every day. I thought maybe we'd have to get to Ark pretty soon. And we sat in these meetings and hear these old fat, smug pukes talk and hate it. And I had no idea that'd be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be. Had no intention of staying sober. I thought they were all dismal, and what they talked about was even more dismal. And that was Halloween 1958, and I didn't have any idea it would be my sobriety date. If I'd known it was Halloween, I'd have gone out to a costume party and won a prize. But I look, people say, well, what is the big thing happen? I'll tell you what. Since I had to go to meetings every night at that damn club, I saw one guy in the meeting, I saw him in two or three meetings, that I'd seen in the movies. I thought, aha, a movie star. He probably is richer than the rest of these pukes. So I thought, I bet he'd like to have a new friend. So I kind of moved in on him, but he didn't want a new friend, turned out. And by Friday, I was sleeping in that damn car, eating cake, and dying. I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought, I'm going to have to sell out. I heard people about doing this. I'd never done this till I had some pride. But I thought, I'll have to ask that movie star to be my sponsor. So I went up to him. I said, Bob, I'm really so impressed by your program. Would you be my sponsor? He said, okay. He said, if I want you to do it, I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. God, that was terrible. My final sellout. And I found out later he wasn't a movie star at all. He'd been in three movies, had character roles in three movies, and I'd seen two of them, so I thought he was in a lot of movies. In the last few years, I've been in more movies than he ever was, but I didn't know it then. And so they said he wasn't a very good actor, but he was a good actor because he acted well at meetings, and that took a lot of acting for him. He was a right-wing fascist AA puke of the worst sort. Just do this, try this. I thought, why am I letting this guy run me ragged? Because I almost immediately understood I am much smarter than he is. I got such a better brain than he is, but I can't let him know it, because nobody wants to sponsor someone smarter than you are. So I have to play games like you'd say something stupid, and I say, Jesus, Bob, I never thought of that. Did you want to cut my throat? But if it ever stops raining in this damn Los Angeles, I'm getting out of here. But I look back now and I have very warm feelings for him, because he didn't like me much either, I think. But he tried to help me, and he tried to help me as best he could. And he would take me some times with him to meetings where he was talking, or he'd come and talk to me in the club and give me a cup of coffee and a piece of cake, perhaps. And he really was a nice guy. He was a man of very strong opinions, but, you know, what do I care? I was too. Why would I stay sober this time? Because I'd been worked on, well, I'll tell you, just in passing, although I didn't know this at the time. In 1953, Bill was so concerned about his sponsor, Ebby, that he sent him to Texas to a guy who worked with slippers, and he kept him sober for 7 years. He spoke at the 1960 International Convention. I heard him speak there. And that guy worked on me for a while. Didn't do any good at all. I mean, I had no belief at all what they were saying was right. I had a lot of people over the years try to help me. I just thought, you dumbbells. But why would I stay sober this time? Because somehow he got into my head a little bit. I didn't know that's how you stay sober in AA, and I didn't know he was doing it. But he had like strong opinion. We were at Brentwood or someplace like that. And he was the speaker. The first speaker said something to the effect of, I'm just so happy to be sober. You know, I got sober here a few months ago, and now my family's back and my job is going well, and I don't really have time for meetings anymore. But it discovered I don't need them. Once I found sobriety, I found what I was looking for. And I thought, geez, that's another success story. And old Bob nailed him after the meeting and just gave him hell. He said, you shouldn't be in AA. You're wasting our time here. You used up a seat we should use. It was just crazy talk. And on the way back to the club, I said, Jesus, Bob, why did you give that guy such hell? You know, he says, he said his problem was alcohol. I said, Bob, I've got a breakthrough announcement for you. AA is designed to help people with alcohol problems. I had told him I wasn't an alcoholic. He knew that, but I was able to understand what it was. He said, no, it isn't. People with alcohol problems shouldn't come to AA. I said, Jesus, Bob, that's a pretty hot under the lights out there today, the set here. He said, kid, I'll tell you, people have an alcohol problem, what they should do is this. They quit drinking, they clean up their act, and when they're asked to have a drink, they say, no, thank you. I said, that's ridiculous, Bob. I've tried that 150 times. It doesn't work. He said, yes, kid, your problem isn't alcohol. You must suffer what I got to suffer from. I said, what the hell is that, Bob? He said, something that sounds like alcohol and fools people till they die from it. It's something called alcoholism. I thought, oh, Jesus, Bob, don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than you'd ever believe. You mean to tell me that alcoholism is the answer? If I say, I'm an alcoholic, my problem's alcoholism, I'm cured, hooray, hooray. Shut up, he explained. And he gave me about a 3-hour harangue, most of which I was able to blot out before I went insane. But in that talk somewhere, he said something that changed my life. I had no idea at the time. I didn't have it for a long time afterwards. He said, kid, get this. Here's the difference. I told you what an alcohol problem is. Now, this thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye. It's easy to be mistaken. But it's a mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism. You'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't possibly stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that before. They always say getting sober is the answer. He said, getting sober unless you do something about it makes it worse. I know that, but geez, then why do these alcoholics drink? You know, now that's broken my concentration, I'll have to start over. My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I said, why do these alcoholics drink if it does such terrible things to them all the time? He says, they don't, kid. He says, you say you've been around 8-10 years, you don't seem to know very much. He says, you know what an alcoholic is? It's a person who gets an unnatural reaction to alcohol. And I know that, Bob. It sets up the phenomenon of craving. Then you go insane and drink till you go crazy. Say, that's podium talk. I'll tell you why alcoholics drink, and he had a cup of coffee in his hand. He said, if this were Johnny Walker, and I took a big drink. It almost instantly alters my perception of reality. Makes it a softer place. Well, I have a couple more drinks, it almost instantly alters my relationship to the world around me. Hi, how you doing, baby? It almost instantly inside of me makes me taller and stronger and tougher and them smaller and less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, I know that feeling. What's wrong with that? He said, because it is not really happening, you moron. I understand that. I said, you mean, why is it that a lot of people can go to bars and have a beer and go home and I go to stay there? He said, that's the part of it, kid. Less than 10% of people who drink alcohol get those emotions I've just described. But those people, if they get them, they're screwed. Because they stay there, and you drink to get back there. And without them, your personal view of life is rather dull and gray and not very pleasant. But when you drink, you hear the band start. It's just wonderful. That's true, Bob. He says, now, you told me the other night that you committed suicide once upon a time. Do you know that everybody in AA thinks about it or has thought about it or is going to do it once upon a time? I said, watch him sometime. Some guy came into a bar. Maybe have a couple going-away drinks. I did the best I could. She left me and the kids. Damn job. They just didn't ever understand me. Bad breaks and misunderstandings. And 10 minutes later, you're down the bar saying, you with anyone, Granny? It just changes things. And later on in my life, when I got sober longer, I understood what they meant with this. It's a disease of perception. What makes alcoholism dreadful is that it changes my perception of reality. Nothing else does that. I said, Jesus, Bob, I understand that because that's why I drink, so I feel better. But now, tonight the other night, there was a woman at the meeting who said she was sober and then drank again. Why did she do that if it was so damn good to be sober? He said, that's the other part of the disease, kid. He said, he had a theory that I thought was stupid at the time, but I heard a tape of it many years later. I thought, that's really right on. He said, when people are born and raised, it's tough growing up in the world. When you're a kid, nobody cares what you think or what you want very much, really. Nobody pays much attention to you. They expect you to solve problems you don't understand, resolve complexes you don't deal with, and every time you fall in love, you know you're going to have your heart broken before it's over, and just terrible. And we don't even know what the goal is. What's the goal, Bob? He said, reaching a stage of emotional maturity. Some people do it when they're 18. Some people do it when they're 50. But it almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He He said, because we've discovered when we find a painful solution, painful problem we can't deal with, or a conflicting situation, or an obsession that I don't know what to do about, I've learned that I have the power to drink it away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch, I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Carlson, take your job and shove it up your nose. I said, I know that, Bob. I've done that. All those things. He said, I'll tell you something. His theory was, every time that worked, it created some sort of invisible ball in your stomach, in your psyche somewhere. That just, for as soon as you get a psyche full of balls, doesn't make a difference. The only time they become active is when you get willing to, when you want to stop drinking. Then they lay poised. And sooner or later, sometimes very soon, whether it's at home or in the job or in the street, someone will start them going. Someone will hurt your feelings. Someone will put you down. Someone will treat you badly. Someone will treat you condescendingly. Someone will say something bad about you. And the balls go to work. And it gets kind of bad. For me, it was in work situations. And when I was a young man, I had a solution to it. I just quit my job and I'd punch the guy in the face and I'd be done. But when you got a house full of kids, you can't do that anymore. So I try to think, what is making this guy do this? And little by little, try to get some kind of revenge without being caught. And pretty soon you see his friends are probably in on it too, because they're looking at you funny. And he goes on and on. And I remember lying awake at night thinking, God, what are we going to do with these pukes? And it gets to the point, finally, that you can't stand it. Scientists who study alcoholics like us say that we can get to a point where we literally must drink to preserve our sanity. Isn't that ironic? And pretty soon I'll drink, and pretty soon it'll all go away again. Oh, clients, you had a big job making all that money. What happened? Oh, they're a bunch of phonies. I got out of there. I'll get a better job, and I would. And I knew all the problems. I said, well, that's a very nice explanation, Bob. But that's the story of my life for the last 10 years. I have had some big jobs, and I've been famous, and I made a lot of money, and I was pretty successful. And now I'm living in a damn abandoned car, taking crap from people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn last year. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh, because he's rather profane. What could that name be, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, no, I'm not an alcoholic. I drink, but I'm not an alcoholic. I explained that to you. My problem is not really alcohol. That's right, he said. Alcoholics aren't people whose problem is alcohol. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol. And then you're going to become your problem after a while. And that was in December of 1958. I was dry 6 weeks, waiting to make my move. And nothing changed in my life. It was still bad, but I still had the... What it did for me, as far as I can recall, is that it relieved much of the feeling that I was secretly insane. Because there's no other way to explain it to yourself to people, you know. You won't... In fact, one of my first few years, somebody would tell me, jokingly said, you're insane, and made me furious because I spent years secretly thinking I was. But I thought, what if there is a pattern there? And my life didn't change, but I began hearing people talking in meetings differently, and it began to reinforce what he had told me. I don't think I ever got changed much by any sentence or any word, but if the phrase worked out, the people I respected were talking about that same thing, I understood it. And I stayed sober. And I finally moved in somebody's basement. And I got a little job as a dishwasher at the Gaty Delicatessen. And I got fired after 3 days because, well, I hate to bring it up, but it seemed to me the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. So I thought they're bringing in dishes from other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm an Anglo. Well, I was wrong, it turned out. I was fired. But I had a bunch of little jobs to get fired. Remember one time I was about 4 months sober. I went back to the club and I said, Sully, your name is John Sullivan, manager. I said, you know, Sully, I'm never going to be anything. I'm trying to do better than Bob's trying to help me and all, but Christ, these idiots around here holding jobs and I can't hold a job. And what can I do? He said, listen, kid. He said, now you talk about committing suicide. Don't commit suicide unless you think about this. There's about 4 people in this club who like you and they defend you. There's about 150 people who think you're an asshole. And they would like to see you banned out of the club. If you commit suicide, you will make those people who love you feel bad, and you'll make those jerks feel good. Is that what you want? No, it isn't! I'll keep going. But I finally held a job about, I don't know, a couple of months before I got fired. I got a birthday cake finally. It was wonderful. And I got my second year, I held a job, one job, almost 7 months before I got fired. I got, by this time, I had a little room in Hollywood next little with a fold-out bed and a little alcove with a small refrigerator and a heater, and that, you know, you could cook things. God, I loved that more than any big mansion I ever lived in. And at the end of my second birthday, some people put in some clout for me, it turned out, and got me a job as a beginning writer at a medical corporation. Well, I'd been a very successful writer, but I was glad to get that job. I still had no front teeth. My sponsor took me down to the thrift shop, got me some clothes that didn't fit me very well, and I learned to carry my lip like this. And I went to work there, and the first month or two, they said, gee, Clancy, we got a problem here. We got this medical thing we got to write, and we can't find a way to do it. You want to take a crack at it? And I said, sure. And I read this thing, and God, I'd written a treatise on it 8 years before that. It was much better than everything I had. And I wrote that, and they just loved it. Oh, Clancy, you're doing wonderfully. I knew I was on my way. And then one day I heard a guy say, that guy didn't even have any front teeth. Here it starts. It's just going to get worse from now on. I might as well just pop this guy and quit because it's not going to get any better. I thought, if I do that, I'll have to explain it to that damn Bob. So I called him, Bob. I said, Bob, this guy's ridiculing me. He said, what did he say? He said, you don't have any front teeth. He said, you don't have any front teeth, do you? I said, no, that's not the point. He's ridiculing me and trying to make me look bad, Bob. He said, well, ask him why he said it. I said, are you kidding? I know why he said it. He said, ask him why he said it. So I got this guy aside. I said, I understand you think it's funny I don't have any front teeth, huh? He said, oh, no, it's just the opposite. I was telling someone, you know, you got ill-fitting clothes, obviously second-hand clothes, and you got no front teeth, and you don't look like a ghost. He said, obviously something bad has happened to you back there somewhere, and you're trying to make a comeback. And based on what you've been writing, you're doing a good job. And my hat's off to you. And I said, oh. But I went to Bob with a lot of hurt feelings in the next couple of years. By the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that big medical corporation. Had front teeth, smiled a lot. If any of you new people back there are missing teeth, let me give you hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. When I was 7 years sober, brought into Hollywood, another guy and I, we created the number one hard rock station in the world, something called Boss Radio. Became a big national hit. We brought the Beatles into Los Angeles. We were slicker than you can imagine. 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations with an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet and leaped out of their post office box and rushed to my side and attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. And 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. But it was a little boy, so I forgave her. It was just wonderful. And I was making progress today. The only problem I had, I want to say quickly, because it may help some new people. Bob says, well, time for us to go through the steps now that you believe you're an alcoholic. I said, Bob, I cannot go through the steps. I cannot return to God. I just can't do it. I have a reason of my own. He said, nothing in AAS says you return to God. Oh, really? What does it say? Return to a power greater than yourself. Is that supposed to fool people? Don't fool me. He says, doesn't say that at all. Why don't you read the damn steps on the wall? It asks you to come to believe in something. Can't you come to believe that there's a loving God? I said, no. He said, can't you believe in Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, I like it better than I used to, but not a hell of a lot. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are, Bob. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that. And to those who are new, I want you to know something. You think you have to return to a God that you've been worried about. You have to come to believe there's a power here of some kind. It might be your sponsor. It might be the power of the group. Because I'll tell you a secret. These people didn't all stay sober just so they could come and fool you. There's a power here that seems to work for people. And but the thing that hangs up, if you're thinking, is that it's going to restore you to sanity. What the hell is sanity? Explain that to me. You can read 10 textbooks on mental health and get 10 different definitions of sanity. Oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. When the human brain is under sufficient duress, it can no longer find any way to continue its neural integrity, it will sometimes reach out and change its perception of reality. That is called psychosis. When you have psychosis, some things look different to you. If you're really bad, the whole world looks different to you, but some, usually it's just rifled amounts. And you read about it in the papers. You read stories like, well, this guy, I lived next door to this guy for 10 years, and he just came home one night, took a rifle, killed his kids, killed his wife, killed himself. Why would he do that? Something triggered his psychosis. But as it was explained to me, what I was struggling through, this almost never happens to alcoholics. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Now, doesn't that sound strange? You'd think we do because we act psychotic, but we get very neurotic. But if you become psychotic, you stay that way. You don't psychotic, you stay that way. And alcoholics almost never become psychotic after they're sober. And I asked a guy in Washington one time, the National Institute of Health or something, why this would be. It's quite simple. When alcoholics, when it becomes bad enough, they drink alcohol. And alcohol for them has the power to alter their perception of reality. You and I have the power to induce temporary psychosis if we choose. Then tomorrow will be bad again, but we got away tonight. And so I think what, you know, it all seemed to me so odd that people always want to spend hours and days studying the steps, what they mean. They mean what they say. It's hard to understand that. The second step means there's a power, you and I must recognize there's a power here that will make it unnecessary for me to drink alcohol. That's all. I'm not going to go through the steps, just one more. Because we got to the third step, I couldn't deal with that. Because that lays it right out there. Turn your will and life over to the care of God as you understand them. My sponsor wanted me to write an inventory, and I didn't want to do it. I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist, and I do it, but I don't need it, and writing, turning my life over. And I hung on for quite a while. One night I was feeling so bad, I got to solve this, or else I'm going to go back out for sure. So I found myself writing the third step that I could live with. I will try to do what Bob says. And that changed, saved my life. Saved my life. I wrote an inventory because Bob wanted me to write an inventory. I read it to him. I tried to change my life little by little. And as the years went by, my life began to spruce up a bit. And it's now been 52 years. And I'll be 52 years next month. And I haven't had a drink, I haven't had a pill, I haven't seen a psychiatrist. I saw a psychiatrist for a few years, but only because I was his sponsor and made him go to meetings. But, you know, I've sponsored some exotic guys, my day. Had the pleasure. I sponsored the guy that put the flag on the moon. Sponsored Academy Award winning director, who in his presentation talk thanked me. So I want to thank my sponsor, Clancy. And I was on the plane somewhere. I didn't hear it. It just killed me. But somebody taped it. I heard it again and again and again. But I've also sponsored, most of the people I've sponsored have been low bottom drunks, though, like me, because those are the ones I really identify with. But the point of it all is that alcohol, somewhere in this area of my life, I began to understand something that I never knew before. And a lot of people never know it, as far as I can tell. What is the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, it's to get dry and stay dry. I've been dry for 52 years. I may burst into flame at any moment up here. No, it isn't. It took me a while to understand this. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To change my perception of reality and make it a more friendly place. To change my relationship to the world around me so I can live with some degree of dignity. To build enough self-worth so a passing remark or an unpleasant look will not demolish me for days. To live with some degree of hope in the world. And it's hard to remember, because sometimes you hear speakers talk about they've achieved perfection. I've turned my life over to God, and God and I now walk hand in hand. Then I begin to notice God seemed to give him a beer every once in a while, too. Boom. I was so disappointed in myself that I didn't get better. And again, someone pointed out to me that, you know, no matter how hard you work the program, you never rise above human being. And human beings are fallible and they're emotional. That's the whole thing about the disease of perception. Why they say, for example, don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Why? Because they're perception distorters. When I'm hungry, the people that work for me get more and more stupid every minute. Come on, get that paper in here, for Christ's sake! I explain. When I'm angry, sometimes God seems to be telling me, why don't you kill him for his own good? When I'm lonely, I know they're all having a party somewhere, but they didn't tell me. When I'm tired, they literally attack. I'm sure you've noticed this. I get on the freeway in the morning. I live out by the ocean in Los Angeles. I go downtown, and I get on the freeway, and I can conceal fatigue. I may have driven 200 miles the night before to talk to some goofs in Bellflower or someplace. But I come back, and I'm very tired. I get to go to work. But I can disguise it. I hum a little song. And I notice up by La Cienega, some old lady in a Buick or something. She says, see the boy in the Mercury Marquis? He's exhausted. I'm going to cut him off. But AA has taught me one thing. I no longer have to chase people on the freeway past my exit. If I haven't caught him by San Pedro Street, it's good flying, Red Baron, but we will meet again. Just once did I ever overcome that. I came off the Santa Monica Freeway under the Harbor Freeway. Some little girl in a car almost killed me. I mean, I missed by an inch. Just, oh, God. And I thought, I'll have to make an exception, because once when you catch them, you can't do anything. You can just glare at them. But this, I chased her up the Pasadena Freeway. Caught her in about 5 miles. I gave her a quadruple glare. Then I realized she was about 17. Looked almost exactly like my granddaughter, Katie, with long yellow hair. I thought, what kind of an old curmudgeon am I? A little girl driving a car, maybe going to get a job and doing wonderful things, and I'm scowling at her. So I smiled, and she went, that changes your perception for a while. So one of the best things I know about AA is to remember that. And we have some spiritual rules that we try to give to newcomers in our group. They're not very spiritual, but they're pretty good. One, be where you said you would be. when you said you would be there. Two, don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back, employees, waiters and waitresses. And three, on days you're having a bad day, keep your mouth shut because you're going to lash out at somebody that you wish you hadn't. And those seem so dumb. Childlike things. That's for children, not for grown-up people. But for grown-up people, it turns out, people like us, I've heard it described, when alcohol begins to work, your emotional maturing stops. Because I no longer have to deal with the problem thing. And one of the great things about AA, it gives me a chance to start doing things that start to keep my maturity growing a little bit. Grows much slower than I like, but it does. And I live in a world surrounded by a lot of hectic things. I've had some delightful things happen. I've been active in AA for over half a century, so I've had a chance to do some things that most people don't get to know. Last few years, I've talked in South Africa and Bangkok and Scandinavia and Ireland, all over the world. And it's a funny thing, you know. You would think that AA would be different in these places, but except for the accents, you hear the same emotions, the same feelings that you hear in your newcomers meeting. They don't like me, and I don't want to talk about it. But the goal of AA, as I say, is what you've got to remember if you're new, is that to start feeling good. And it doesn't come in one fell swoop one day. It comes little by little in smidgens. You don't even know it's coming sometimes. It can happen briefly in your first 30 days. You can feel good for 2 seconds. What was that feeling? I felt good there for a moment. You know. I'll tell you what it boils down to is this. It makes you feel some degree of confidence. In that little design back there, I was sitting down there at the meeting last night looking at it, but I wasn't listening intently to the speaker. And I was thinking, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. If you're new, you look in that triangle and it's just a mishmash of sponsor, books, conventions, meetings, steps. What the hell's all this about? So what you have to do is kind of turn it upside down. And you look at it, it still says a big mishmash. But at the bottom of the point, there's a point to Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a point that I got to remember, and I believe you have to remember, because it's the same today in Ocean City as it was June 10th, 1935, in Akron, Ohio. The point of AA is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. When that moment comes, you got him. A great thing. The last thing I want to say is, one of the great changes in my perception, I know I was sober a few years, and I was talking to Chuck Chamberlain one day. I said, God hates me. I don't want to hear about God. He said, I got some bad news for you, Clancy. He says, you're not important enough for God to hate. That hurt me a lot. But that night I tried to say my first prayer, and I've been praying earnestly now for 45 years to a loving God that I never would have believed in otherwise. And my life changed. My higher power became God, and Alcoholics Anonymous became the expression of that God. I think that's what it's about. And when I was 15 years sober, as I was saying, I was a marketing director of Beverly Hills. Now it's doing great. But I got such a wave of well-being that I can't believe it now. One day I left my job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 36 years, I've been the managing director of the Midnight Mission on Skid Row, the place that threw me out in 1958. And people, this is the this is the signal for applause. This is the signal for muffled crying. But people said, why would you give up your damn career in West Beverly Hills to run that damn mission? And there's no good answer for that. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. 3 of my daughters just turned 21 this summer at the International Convention in AA. My last little boy has turned into an alcoholic who's now getting a divorce from his wife. I have a grandson who's a year sober. I have, Beth, I have 2 great-grandsons. one of whom is a potential alcoholic. Either that or he's the spawn of the devil or something. But I'll tell you, I'll tell you about a very drab, unexciting life. Monday morning, whatever you're doing, I'm going to get up to my house out in the west side of Los Angeles, big yard, big house. There's 100 AAs today playing ball in my backyard, softball and volleyball. And I'll get in my car and drive through Beverly Hills and down to Skid Row, where it's just all a big shambles. And I'll park underneath our building, and I'll take my walk around the building and see who's still alive and who I know and who's dying, and sometimes step over the bodies of men, women, or children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and insanity and abandonment. And I go in and spend the day with my staff trying to figure out how can we get to these poor bastards and get them moving before they die. And you don't get very many on Skid Row, I'll tell you, because they're set. But you get a few. And sometimes later I've been able to give them birthday cakes. 1 5 years recently, which is a great feeling. But the whole point of the action is just what I'm saying. It is the day I got sober in 1958 is a day like the day 9/11 was, or like Kennedy's death. These were days when there was no reason to keep going, and somehow something changed my life. Alcoholics Anonymous, a God that I believe looks after me, and the courage to change my actions whenever my emotions allow me to do that. So I'm very glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober. And I thank you all for it. Thank you.